Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Had a victim here in Alaska who, to her great credit, had the courage to make a report.
An Alaska Girls report leads investigators to a major child pornography scheme. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 6th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, how the state's fishing permit system has affected local communities.
These types of management systems don't serve villages. In fact, they tend to undermine village fishing livelihoods and village sustainability.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at NEAAlaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
Two Russians who said they fled the country to avoid compulsory military service were detained on St. Lawrence Island in Alaska earlier this week. The two unidentified men arrived in Gamble by boat on Tuesday. By Wednesday morning, they were transferred to Anchorage, according to U.S. Coast Guard officials. Officials in Gamble said the men told locals they were fleeing the Russian military. They've requested asylum in the U.S. Russian President Vladimir Putin has drafted up to 300,000 men for Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Many potential draftees have sought to leave the country. Governor Mike Dunleavy said yesterday that he does not expect a continual stream of people traversing the same route. He also warned that travel in the region could be dangerous during an upcoming storm. In a statement today, Senator Dan Sullivan said, quote, "Given Alaska's proximity to Russia, our state has a vital role to play in securing America's national security," end quote. Senator Lisa Murkowski called for additional federal resources to be sent to Alaska. An Alaska girl's report to authorities that she had been extorted for sexually explicit images of herself started an investigation into what prosecutors say is one of the worst child pornography schemes the FBI has ever seen. The investigation that she set into motion also led to the arrest of a man described as the conspiracy's ringleader more than 6,000 miles away. Zubaydul Amin, a 24-year-old Bangladeshi national, the Royal Malaysia Police apprehended in Kuala Lumpur in September. Assistant U.S. Attorney Adam Alexander is prosecuting the case.
We had a victim here in Alaska who, to her great credit, had the courage to make a report to the Alaska State Troopers. And then we're very fortunate here just to have close working relationships between state and local and federal law enforcement agencies.
A grand jury had indicted Amin in July on 13 charges related to his alleged sexual exploitation of children through social media apps, according to a redacted version of the indictment that a judge ordered unsealed on Wednesday. According to the indictment, Amin posed as a teenager on Instagram to meet minors, who he convinced to send him sexually explicit photos and video of themselves on different social media apps, including Snapchat. The indictment says Amin distributed the child pornography to co-conspirators using the file-sharing app Dropbox. Federal prosecutors with the Department of Justice said in a statement Thursday that Amin had targeted hundreds of victims, and according to the indictment, at least one was as young as 11 years old. Alexander, the prosecutor, says offenders like Amin tend to try to take advantage of a child's understandable shame of being exploited by using threats.
What that means is they will try to find all of the friends and family members and associates that a child has on a social media platform or on multiple platforms, and then exploit the child by extorting them to produce more images of child exploitation by threatening to release the ones they already have to literally everybody the child knows.
That's what's alleged to have happened to the girl from Alaska, identified in the indictment only as Victim A, who communicated with Amin from September to December of 2021. When Victim A stopped sending photos and having sexually explicit video calls with Amin, The indictment says he sent the videos to her friends and family. Amin allegedly used similar tactics on other victims. The FBI's Anchorage field office and its Child Exploitation and Human Trafficking Task Force continues to investigate the case. They're asking that anyone with more information about Amin's activities call 1-800-CALL-FBI. The Anchorage School District is considering closing schools to help fill a giant budget deficit next year. School closures are just one option on the table, but as Alaska Public Media's Katie Anastas reports, declining enrollment in the district means there are too many buildings with not enough kids.
The Anchorage School District faces a budget gap of at least $68 million next year. And one of the big reasons is the decline in student enrollment. Over the last 10 years, enrollment has dropped by 5,000 students. Now, there are 18 schools in the district operating at less than 65% capacity. Closing some schools could be one way to help fill the budget deficit, says District Chief Financial Officer Jim Anderson. But he knows it won't be easy.
Everywhere you go, that community loves, adores their neighborhood school. It is a community center in many cases.
The district hired consultant Shannon Bingham to help figure out which schools to close or repurpose. He says birth rates are declining and fewer young couples are moving to Anchorage. As fewer young kids enter the school system, elementary schools shrink. But as those kids grow up, Anderson says, all schools will eventually feel the impact.
Ultimately, that will end up reaching middle schools. And years down the road, if that doesn't change, and if we don't get something in Anchorage that draws in families with children, then ultimately that will certainly impact high schools as well.
Bingham is working on a list of potential schools to close. He plans to share it at the next school board meeting on October 18th. That list will be based on a range of factors, including the condition of school buildings, how much money has gone into recent repairs, and how combining or closing certain schools could impact district bus routes. A big factor is the capacity of a building and how many sections or classes per grade level are at the school.
Right now, our average building is about 1.9 sections per grade level at the elementary level. So in order to become more efficient, we would want to make that larger.
Combining some smaller schools into one could bring that number of sections per grade to 3 or 4. And Anderson says there are some potential benefits for students and staff. Kids at larger schools may have better access to electives, like sports or debate teams that might not have enough interested students at smaller schools. It can also improve their access to specialists, like those who help students with reading. Anderson says currently, some specialists go to several schools to work with a small number of students.
They go to multiple schools to see just a couple people, as opposed to having a larger school where maybe you would have a full-time specialist at that school serving the needs of all the students 5 days a week instead of maybe once a week.
The district is also considering making all middle schools 6th grade through 8th grade. Bingham says that would allow the middle school buildings to serve more kids and free up space in elementary schools during mergers. Anderson says high schools are the least likely to close, since the district plans to implement new college and career preparation programs in the coming years. That means elementary schools are the most likely candidates for closures or mergers. After the list comes out, Anderson says the district will host town hall meetings with those school communities from October 26th through November 3rd. In Anchorage, I'm Katie Anastas.
Still to come in Alaska News Nightly, in Western Alaska, the September storm brought damage and some unexpected treasures.
And I was like, holy cow, look at this. It was a message in a bottle.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
79 million sockeye salmon returned to Bristol Bay this summer. It was the largest run on record, and it's great news for the commercial fishery. But the record run is also reigniting conversations about big disparities in who gets to fish and how the state's limited entry system has affected the communities closest to the runs. KDLG's Izzy Ross reports.
For a long time, Alaska had no limits on how many people could sign up to commercial fish. Dillingham resident and Chukyong tribal member William P. Johnson has fished since he was a kid in the 1940s.
In the early years, there were many people who were participating in the fishery, and they hired their local people in there from their village to participate with them.
But in the 1960s, the number of out-of-state fishermen was growing, while salmon runs were shrinking. And in 1972, Alaskans voted for the state to amend the Constitution to start limiting how many commercial fishing permits were allowed in regions like Bristol Bay, a system called limited entry. The goal was to reduce the pressure on fisheries and financially sustain the fishermen who depended on them. But in the 50 years since, local permit ownership in Bristol Bay has actually declined by half.
With the out-migration, you can see the effect that it has on the monetary return to the individual village people through their commercial fishermen.
The new system quickly and fundamentally changed the Bristol Bay fishery and the communities that relied on it, according to Rachel Donkersloat. She led the latest study on the impacts of limited entry. Donkersloat's report says 7 years into the program, Alaska Native permit holdings in Bristol Bay had already declined by 21%.
As is often the case, these types of management systems don't serve villages. In fact, they tend to undermine village fishing livelihoods and village sustainability.
According to Donkersloat and other researchers, there were issues with the new system from the beginning. The permit application was confusing and ended up favoring non-rural fishermen. Fred Teresi came to Dillingham as a lawyer with the state's legal services in the 1970s and remembers helping local fishermen through the change. He says before limited entry, anyone could fish as long as they had a boat. Limited entry introduced permits people only received once. The permit application was supposed to favor rural fishermen, but Teresi says it fell short.
It was a kind of a complicated application by design because it was meant to determine who really needed a permit, who really had been relying on it in the past.
The state tried to address those problems. It created the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission as part of the new system, which held legal hearings in rural Alaska to handle legal challenges. But limited entry meant that permits were freely transferable, so they could be bought, gifted, or inherited. That meant that many local people who didn't have access to other sources of income sold their permits and could not afford to buy back into the fishery. Johnson, the Dillingham fisherman, says he was able to hold on to his permit during that time because he worked all year round. But many local fishermen weren't able to do so.
People, because of poor runs, began selling their permits. And, of course, that impacted mainly the local people. They couldn't afford to make a living fishing, and so many of them ended up selling their permits just to get by for a couple of years.
In the nearly 50 years since the change, the value of Bristol Bay's fishery has grown exponentially. But most of that revenue leaves the state. Donkersloat says residents of Bristol Bay also tend to earn less than urban and non-resident fishermen, even though fishing is more likely to be their only source of income.
What matters most in terms of the benefits from fisheries is where the permit holder lives. It's not where fish are landed. It's not these other factors at play. It's where the permit holder lives.
When limited entry was implemented, the report says the state didn't build in safeguards to help local operators continue to fish. Donkersloot says the gap in access to the fishery between locals and other fishermen often boils down to financial circumstances, like access to capital and credit history. Donkersloot says when the state crafted limited entry, it also didn't take into account cultural differences around fishing.
That gets back to kind of the misfit between trying to support rural fishery participation and programs like limited entry, which individualize and commodify the right to fish.
The outmigration of fishing permits from rural Alaska is a controversial and complex topic that legislators, Alaska Native community leaders, residents, and economists have repeatedly tried to address. Donkersloot says in order to address the disparity, the public policy surrounding the fishery needs to change.
This is about, you know, sustainable economic development in Bristol Bay, and you cannot have that conversation without thinking about fisheries.
The report lays out a few paths forward that Donkersloot says have worked in other regions and countries that have dealt with similar problems. They include provisions for small-scale operations, apprenticeship permits, and creating locally designated permits. As the fishery celebrates another huge run, Donkersloot says it's important to think about who is able to participate in the fishery and why. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
A storm that battered Alaska's west coast in September brought with it hurricane-force winds and high seas. Resulting damage in some communities was extensive. Homes were flooded and personal belongings were destroyed. But as Emily Schwing reports for Alaska Public Media, the storm also left a few treasures in its wake.
High water reached all the way to Chivac, 17 miles inland from the Bering Sea coast. It tossed boats like bath toys and scattered debris across the community.
And it was just all water all over.
Norma Tanutmuk went out after the storm with her husband to survey the damage. Flooding carried loads of driftwood inland. And Tanutmuk, an avid beachcomber, says she spotted something tangled among a pile of logs.
And I was like, holy cow, look at this. It was a message in a bottle.
She shows off a brown glass bottle. It has a cork stopper, and inside there's a rolled up piece of paper. According to the message inside, this bottle has been floating around in the Pacific Ocean and the Bering Sea for more than 20 years.
It was some guy doing survey for ocean currents 22 years ago.
From Canada, right?
From Canada.
It was dropped from a boat off the coast of Vancouver in 2000 as part of a long-term study on ocean currents. Tanutmuk has been in touch with the scientist whose name and contact number are listed on the message. He's since retired. Were you hoping for anything in particular?
Yeah, something personal or something someone sent out from another part of the world. But it's okay. It's still an amazing find.
She plans to display the bottle and its message on a shelf in her kitchen. Up and down Alaska's west coast, people have reported finding all sorts of treasures, from glass fishing floats to shoes and all sorts of other flotsam. What Bruno Chakuchin found didn't float in on a tide. It washed out of the tundra near Newtok.
Half of it was showing from the tip and all the way to the end of it.
It was a giant prehistoric tusk.
Mud was covering it.
And it was huge, right?
Yeah, like it was huge.
Like, describe how big it was.
It was like 8 feet, 10 inches, I think.
8 feet?
Yeah. Probably a diameter of 1 foot and 6 inches, maybe.
Coastal erosion is severe in this part of Alaska. Chakuchin has found other mammoth tusks over the years, but he says this one was by far the largest. It weighed 128 pounds.
Whoa, it weighed more than I do.
Yeah, I couldn't lift it alone because it was too heavy.
He says tusks like this bring in good money from collectors and artists.
Depending on condition, they'll go for about $150 a pound if it's in really good condition.
That kind of cash can go a long way in a small community like Newtalk. Chikuchin says it'll help him cover his bills, pay for food, and maybe invest in a four-wheeler. All the beachcombing also offers a nice break for residents who are still cleaning up after their communities were ravaged by flooding, high winds, and a historic storm surge. I'm Emily Schwing, reporting.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Sneezing, aching, sweating, and coughing. Who has the time for this misery? You have the power to protect yourself and your community. Boost your defenses this season by getting the flu vaccine. And make sure to have an updated COVID-19 booster. Help keep your friends and family protected and healthy this winter. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
A proposal to spread tiny glass beads on Arctic sea ice to slow its melting has been discredited. As KUAC's Robin reports, computer modeling at the University of Alaska Fairbanks indicates the geoengineering idea would actually accelerate ice loss and climate warming.
Sea ice is a critical climate regulator. It reflects solar energy back into space. But in the Arctic, ice is melting at an alarming rate, prompting geoengineering ideas, like covering it with a protective layer of hollow glass microspheres, or HGMs.
The problem with them is that they absorb sunlight. So even though it's a tiny percentage, it matters. That's the game changer of what makes this a problematic proposal.
That's Melinda Webster at the University of Alaska. She's an assistant professor who studies sea ice. Her field colleague, Stephen Warren at the University of Washington, told her about a proposal to increase the reflectivity, or albedo, of sea ice to slow the melting. The idea is championed by a group called Arctic Ice Project, which tested the concept on pond ice in Minnesota and Upjavik in 2017. A paper published in 2018 by the group, then known as Ice 911, boasted a promising geoengineering possibility for increasing the albedo of young ice, which would protect it from the sun and allow it to mature over time into highly reflective, multi-year ice. But sea ice isn't always nice and flat like a pond.
And we're thinking, wow, you know, I don't know how this would actually be feasible. Maybe we should account for the wide variety of surface conditions that you can get on Arctic sea ice.
Webster and Warren used the data from the 2018 study that shows the reflectivity of the HGMs, as well as the amount of light that can travel through the beads. From that, they calculated the amount of light that can be absorbed by the microspheres.
What happens when light hits it is a portion of that light is reflected back, a portion travels through the layer, and the remaining portion is absorbed.
She says that absorption actually warms the ice.
That absorption actually is the key reason of why this doesn't work, why this proposal will not halt Arctic sea ice melt.
Webster and Warren also calculated how sunlight and sea ice changes through the year, and they modeled 8 different Arctic ice conditions.
Thin ice with no snow cover, thick ice with a thick cold snow cover, thick ice with a thick melting snow cover, puddles of meltwater on top of the ice, and so on.
Webster says for most of the surfaces during most of the times of year, covering the sea ice with HGMs would backfire.
These hollow glass microspheres would actually darken the surface.
The UAF team reported in their paper the idea could work if a fully light reflective bead could be developed. Webster and Warren's research was published in the October 5th edition of the journal Earth's Future. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
A new ABC drama premieres tonight, Alaska Daily, set at an Alaska newspaper. It stars Hilary Swank as a hard-charging investigative reporter fresh from New York City, but quick to see that her new state has far too many cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women. The series is fiction, loosely based on the Anchorage Daily News. KTOO's Rhonda McBride talked with two Alaska Native writers who have worked on the show.
The common thread between Andrew McLean and Vera Starbard, a desire to tell authentically Alaskan stories.
Overall, I really hope people see in this, in some way, the Alaska that I love.
Vera Starbard is a Tlingit playwright whose career took off when she was tapped to write episodes for the PBS hit children's series Molly from Denali. Her writing partner, Andrew McLean, is Inupiat, known for his award-winning film from 2011, On the Ice. And even though he's familiar with making movies, McLean says nothing prepared him for a TV series like this.
Somebody compared it to building a train while it's hurtling down the track, and I think that's kind of right.
Even as the show premieres, McLean and Starbard are hard at work on upcoming episodes for the season that are yet to be shot.
It's literally hour by hour. You don't totally know what you're going to be doing. So you might show up and think you're going to work on episode 9. And in fact, there's an urgent thing they need to figure out for episode 5 that they're shooting right now. So we need to address that. You're sort of figuring out what you're doing as it comes.
For the past few months, both Starbard and McLean have been sequestered in what they call the writing room in downtown New York City, where they work with producers and writers that they describe as some of the best in the business. But even so, it hasn't been easy to teach them about Alaska.
The need to kind of educate and to make sure that we're being truthful about our depictions of so many different communities, so many different peoples and tribes and ethnicities and so many different lived realities, it can be overwhelming. That probably causes us to lose the most sleep. That causes me to
lose the most sleep. I was literally about to say lose the most sleep over, yeah. Yes.
Roz, I want to put you on a story with Eileen.
Another missing, murdered Native woman.
And we need to show who's to blame.
I work alone. Do you know anything about Alaska?
She always liked this?
McLean says millions of people will watch this show.
And that's a powerful thing. A powerful opportunity to educate and a powerful opportunity just to reach out and to kind of tell our stories, hopefully tell our stories in a truthful, authentic way.
I have such a strong belief, and it's so much of the reason I do the work that I do, that Alaska Native people have amazing, wonderful, beautiful, extraordinary things to give to the world.
And that includes a sense of humor. Just before she left New York City to go home, the crew gave her a card with a word in Tlingit.
And it just says chuk on it, which means go away. And I was like, I taught them too much.
Vera Starbard finds it ironic that to tell stories about Alaska, she had to go all the way to New York City, where she was asked to treat the state as more than just a backdrop, but a character in its own right. In Juneau, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Well, that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Davis Hovey in Nome, Izzy Ross in Dillingham, Emily Schwing in Chivac, Robin in Fairbanks, and Rhonda McBride in Juneau. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.